This is talking with Joan Casa at Duingalo on 10th October 73. And, well, first of all, tell me just a little bit about your background before you came to Holland.
Well, it was really my first job here in Holland. I just fresh from high school and from a technical university when I came here.
In Belgium, yes.
Had work. Short periods at all, but during my student years in electronics, also in Sabena Airlines and even in Sweden, but not real work, student jobs, you know.
Right. And you came here to work with the Stichting, and what was
It was on the Stichting at that time. I was engaged by Belgium.
Oh, yes.
To work on the Benelux Cross Antenna project. I was paid by Belgium. I had nothing to do with the Stichting.
The Stichting
had nothing to do, I think, at that time with the Benelux Cross. It was a joint project between, three countries, although Benelux was only there in name.
But the Stichting was not supporting the Dutch end of it. It was something different.
As far as I know, the Stichting had nothing to do at that time. It was coming right from the ministry.
I see.
In Belgium and in Holland.
Right.
At that time. And a bit later only, the dates, I would have to look back into the records, but you can find it yourself too. In 63, 64, I suppose, when Belgium showed that they were not willing to go on anymore.
Yeah.
Then it was reorganized and the Stichting took over the responsibility.
But what was your... What was your job then, coming to Holland?
Well, I was sent by Professor Coutrey, who was head of the radio astronomy service at the UCO Observatory, Brussels Observatory. And I came here, was interviewed by Christensen and by Ogard.
And they were working for whom at that time?
For the Benelux Cross Antenna.
I see.
So at that time, Christensen was head of the project.
He'd been hired then by the Dutch government.
That's right.
I see.
He was just coming from Paris, if I remember right. He had been working for a year in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
He had just come out of CSIRO and got into the Sydney University, or he was going back to the Sydney University after that, something like that.
Right.
Electrical engineering. So, if I remember right, before Christensen, it was more or less Seegers in charge. I don't know how organized it was because I wasn't there.
Yeah.
But when I came, it was well organized already. They had good idea what they were going to do. And it was Christensen who was in charge of the project. At that time, they were still talking about this 408 megahertz, 5 kilometer cross, with parabolic cylinders, you remember? But in the course of Christensen's stay, it was a year, I think, that he stayed in Leiden, the project changed into this cross, 1.5 kilometers with paraboloids.
Now,
with dishes,
Let me ask. I know Bill Erickson was here for a time. Was that before?
No, after.
That was still after.
When Chris was replaced by Bill Erickson.
I see.
So it would have been 62, 63.
And was that why did the design change at that time?
I don't think that Chris has ever liked very much this 408 megahertz cross. He found it better to make a 21 centimeter instrument. He liked it better. And also, I think there were more finances became available at that time, so that they saw that they could do a better job.
So you could use dishes.
And also, 21 centimeter for Holland was always an important frequency.
Right.
Certainly after the Duingalo telescope got into operation.
So
they jumped onto the opportunity.
So the line was an important consideration for
changing
the frequency. Yeah.
You see, as far as I understand, I wasn't there, of course, but the 408 megahertz big instrument was a cheap device. It was really a chicken wire device.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that more money could be made available. Of course, I was not involved in these days, so I don't know the real detail.
Yeah.
Should ask Paul for it. But I think that's the main criteria.
So,
I'm not sure that Christensen really finished the design when he left. It's probably left to Erickson and Jan Ulbo to polish it. And at about that time, I think 63-64, a paper came out that in a proceeding of an IRE Australia,
right,
describing the instrument as it was thought of at that time.
That's sort of version number two.
That's number two, yes.
Yeah.
It was, I think, using 100 dishes
mm-hmm.
of 25 meters or 30 meters, I don't quite remember something.
Yeah.
Like.
You know, very ambitious.
Very ambitious.
But did they but very really have limited, that much money?
Limited in coverage.
In hour angle
yes.
coverage?
Yes, and the condition, not but hour angle coverage, yes. So that's what, that's why we could probably have so many. No, we cannot because they have to be able to follow for 12 hours.
But was it really, the money really was available for 100 dishes, even of that kind?
Well, that's a good question, so I'm not sure. At least that's what we understood from Ben Oakart, who was really using most of the money.
Mm-hmm.
He claimed at that time that indeed we could pay for 100 dishes.
Right.
The money which was available from Belgium and Holland together, of course. I'm not sure if it is really,
right.
if there was not ever an overestimate of the cost, underestimate of the cost of the dishes. Maybe not, I'm
right.
not sure.
Was
maybe
the
dishes were not so good than they are now, of course.
Yeah.
But it was claimed indeed that we could have paid for so many dishes with the money that was available. So that's twice as much as finally we got, of course. Huh?
Yeah, right. Was it always thought of as 50-50 between Belgium and Holland?
Or? Yes.
And of course, it didn't work finally, but it always seemed strange to me because Holland had such a stronger radio astronomy tradition than Belgium. How did this come about, do you think? I mean, did Belgium just make the decision that they wanted to get into radio astronomy? And this?
Well, they were in radio astronomy already for some time, and they're still in radio astronomy, but mainly in solar work.
But a pretty small way, really, compared to the Dutch effort.
Yes, certainly. Yeah. Certainly, I think it's a question of organization. They haven't got Professor Roy. That's make a hell
really?
Of a difference.
Yeah.
But they have a good instrument.
Well,
extremely good instrument.
Maybe this would be a good time for you to tell me a little bit about Belgian radio astronomy, because I've seen Coutre's name in a couple of reviews in the late 50s, but
yes.
I know nothing at all about.
Coutre wrote a book on radio astronomy. I don't know if you know about that.
No.
I haven't had a show yet.
So, was Coutre sort of the founder of. Belgian radio astronomy?
I don't know.
You don't know?
No, really, I wasn't there either.
Yeah.
And since I came here, I never worked there. Yeah. I never had a chance to find out. All I know that by 1961, I think, they had already their very nice instrument. The mechanical part of this was there.
Mm-hmm.
That's this cross of T with how many? 64 dishes, I believe. They are small, they are a few meters. Only.
Yeah.
But they were good for high frequency.
Operating at what wavelength?
Could have been around 600 megahertz, something
mm-hmm.
like that.
And this was at Uccle, is it?
No, it was in the Ardennes, in the south of Belgium. It's a wonderful spot
uh-huh.
for a radio observatory.
Yeah.
The trouble is that I think it hasn't been organized well, and also the interest is not very large in Belgian radio astronomy. But this is more a question of organization, I believe.
Yeah.
And the electronics. Well, it took years and years to be completed, and I understood 3 months ago that it was finally working.
Right. and the dishes have been there for
yes,
10 years.
10 years, yes.
Now, but where is all this taking place, all this development?
Well, the electronic is developed in Brussels, at the observatory. They have still this radio astronomy service there,
mm-hmm.
on the division. But of course, they have to go to the south of the island to install it and check and make the measurements.
Right.
It is a station like Westerbork,
yeah.
I'd say.
So
but it's mainly solar work.
Right, but this is why you don't see research results coming out of this instrument,
no.
is because...
That's just recent that it's really working. And I haven't seen any results either. I'm not sure how good it is working either, because it's quite a complex system.
Yeah.
They were trying to make a two-dimensional picture of the sun.
Right.
This full instrument cross by sweeping below. Right.
Sort of,
it's also the phase shifter.
Yeah.
It's a T.
It's sort of like Kogura in a way.
Yes, something like that. Although there they have several beams. I'm not sure they have many beams in it.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a whole report on that too, if you're
yes.
interested.
Yeah. I would like to see that after.
Yes.
But there was also other research that went on before this instrument, which you don't know the details about. But
well, as far as I know, of radio astronomy in Belgium, it was slowly solar observatory. Solar observations.
Yeah.
Far as I can see
but
from here.
I still count that as radio astronomy research, though.
But so it is maybe strange that indeed they came together with the Dutch.
Yeah.
But it's maybe a question of friendship too between Professor Couture
yeah.
and Professor Oort.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other professors, astronomers in Belgium who are really interested in what Holland is doing, but they are more theoretical people. Professor Swing, Professor Ledoux,
mm-hmm.
and a few others. About that.
I see. Are there any other people that worked in radio astronomy before the Benelux project in Belgium that you can name?
Yeah, before I came here, there was another Belgian, Cantrain, an engineer from Liège. He was the first Belgian working on the project.
Cantrain.
Cantrain.
Mm-hmm.
But he left before I came, so I met him once only, I think, afterwards. He's still at the University of Liège.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have got quite a good astrophysical department
right.
with Professor Ledoux, Professor Swing, and
mm-hmm.
there he works.
I see. But is he still working in radio astronomy? Or
it's theoretical astronomy, astrophysics, it's
yeah.
No, there's no radio astronomy.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
No. And no other Belgian came, of course, after 64, Belgium was out of the game.
Okay, so let's get back. We've got away from the main topic here.
Yeah.
So Christensen left, and then you said Hoogboom and Ericsson tidied up.
Yes, Ericsson was in charge, of course. Eh? And he stayed for, I would have to look back in the data, but more than a year, I think.
Yeah, I think it was 2 years, something
yes,
like that. It
could have been 2 years, yes.
Then he went to Maryland.
Yes.
Yeah.
And all this happened in Leiden. Dwingeloo had at that stage nothing to do with the project whatsoever.
Well, the site had not been chosen yet, had it?
Well, there were also investigations, particularly done by Raymond. He had been looking for good sites in the region of Weert. That's in Limburg,
mm-hmm.
Near the border, because
right.
he had to be on the border at that
yeah.
time, and they had found a few good sites.
Now, you mean Ernst Raymond?
Ernst Raymond,
yeah.
yes, mm-hmm. yes. There have been a few reports on that.
Right.
But, it didn't last very long.
Okay, then the difficulties happened,
that's right.
What exactly were the difficulties, as you know them anyway?
Well, there were financial problems in Belgium at that time. There was a recession. So they tried to pull out of different projects, and they have more or less to choose between SARS polar expeditions and radio astronomy.
What kind of polar expeditions?
SARS polar.
South polar, oh yes.
You see, Belgium had been there
mm-hmm.
Quite regularly, and it's quite an expensive
yeah.
game. Actually, I think the year after, they had the Dutch representation amongst them in the expedition, a few blocks from Holland went with them.
I see.
Because Holland was not used to go there.
Mm-hmm.
And,
so they chose that?
Yeah. Of course, they didn't say, we pull out of the game, you see, it didn't go like that, but they show more and more reticence. It was more difficult to accept things, to pay, or to get agreement. It was always slowing down. And then I think Oort saw the writing on the wall and
mm-hmm.
decided now. It's going nowhere.
Right.
It's delaying everything here, of course, because no decision is taken. It's always postponed. So he arranged a meeting of the ministers.
Of science?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think in Belgium it was Minister Lefebvre at the time. He died recently, actually, in Belgium. And in Holland, I don't remember what it was. And then they more or less decided to stop the cooperation, at least, or the sharing the money, the cost.
Right.
It would still be a cooperation, of course. Belgium would still be welcome
could,
to use
right,
the telescope.
Could use West
so, you
yeah.
know, after all, they had to pay some money into the project. By the way, somebody else paid some money to the project too, which you maybe not mentioned, is the OECD.
No, I didn't know that. And,
yes.
Well, that's the UN organization.
No. OECD, that's the European Organization for Cooperation to Development, they call it.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what the English initials are to the project,
but
it's a very well-known
I've seen that book from the early 60s when they had a conference on large antennas.
Oh, that's the one, yes. They sponsored that conference, but they have paid some money to the project.
I see.
Yearly they had a lump sum of money. I don't remember how much.
All during these early years?
In all these early years, yes.
And was it a substantial amount?
I wouldn't know. I don't remember.
That's interesting. Yeah. So then the breaking up was not hostile in any way?
By no means, no.
It was just unfortunate
yes.
that Belgium could come up with the mine, yes.
But the main reason, maybe that if they had waited longer, that Belgium would have stayed, you see, but the project would have been delayed too long, because we couldn't order the dishes and so on.
Right.
And we weren't sure if we could do it, if so what happened, because of that we had to break the whole cross into a line.
Because you only could have half the money.
Because we could only have half the money, and this was the idea by Högbom. Because at that time, of course, apogeosynthesis, rotational apogeosynthesis proved successful in Cambridge.
Right.
So it opened new possibilities.
So that's funny, so you get half the array because you have half the countries.
That's right. Well, half the money. And different spot too.
Right. Okay, so then there was no longer a need to have it on the border, and Westerbork, I guess, was a better site than this Limburg site, is that correct?
Yes. Well, certainly Professor Müller wanted to have it around here.
Yeah,
huh?
Right.
It's very normal. He wanted to have his lines as short as possible.
Right.
And he looked for a site around here himself, probably, and found that Westerbork would be very nice. If you look at the woods and so on, it is indeed a nice spot.
Right. So it wasn't markedly superior anyway. It was more when it became Dutch, then it was natural to locate it near where the previous laboratories were and so forth.
Yes. Although probably it would be nice on the south too, you know, near the border. But they had a few problems to the border also with airfields.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of military airfields in the neighborhood, so it might have been a problem.
Yeah. Okay, so now where are we? We're at, where Ericsson is bringing it through this phase, and Ort has decided that it has to be a Dutch project. And then the Dutch government was committed already then for their contribution, so that was no problem to get the additional money. Or not additional,
to
keep it going. Okay.
I think there was a lot of money available at the time, and Holland had really no important projects going on. Nobody was asking for money. That's when Roger Solomy grasped, through Professor, of course, grabbed his chance and got the money.
Oh, yeah. In science, you mean?
Yes.
There were no
nuclear
accelerators?
That's right, yes.
I see.
Really, there was a lot of money available, and nobody really was...
That's an unusual situation.
Yes, yes. It didn't last very long, though.
Right.
But then, of course, the Dutch were committed. And
yeah. Okay, now, what were you doing exactly during these years? You haven't talked about your own...
Well, when I came here, I came to Leiden, of course. There was a nice group there with Jan Högbom. And there was an Australian, Cillian Murray.
Mm-hmm.
He was lecturer at the Sydney University. I don't know if you met him. It was an Indian. It was Sama.
Sama.
Mm. He came here on a visit a year ago, or 9 months ago. He gave a colloquium. I don't know if you were here.
Yeah.
He had just spent 2 years at NRAO working on the regulator.
What is
an Indian.
How do you spell his name?
Well, Sharma, I think.
Mm.
He's an Indian from the Tata Institute.
Mm-hmm.
He worked 2 years with us here. Mainly on the front-end mixers and so on, low noise mixers of 21 centimeter.
Right.
Well, he started 408, of course, because he was there before I came. He started the Seekers. And then, of course, they had to shift, to forget everything they had done, all the studies they had done. They had done a lot of studies on feeds and so on, on the reflection on mesh and so on at 408 meters. They forget everything and start from scratch, it's more than 21 centimeter. And at that time, of course, there was no question of having parents, so we were using balanced mixes,
mm-hmm.
so designing that. And I was working with Cyril Murray on transistor amplifiers. These were also the first transistor amplifiers which were used in radio astronomy.
I see.
Because only at that time did they get better than valves, as far as noise is concerned, you see. Cyril Murray was really the first to use them extensively in radio astronomy as low noise preamplifiers.
And now you're talking now about this development between, what, 61 and 65, or
yes, that's right, yes.
Something like that?
Yes.
Now, in charge of, who was in charge of this receiver development? Was it Mueller?
No, at that time...
This is still before the sinking days.
Yes, sir, that's right. So it was Christiansen in charge of everything. Hmm. But it was, well, there was a loss of freedom. Nothing, there was no real planning yet. The money was not available, so it was really research at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And everything was new anyway.
Yeah.
And we knew that phase was important, and nobody had any clue what the phase would be for the transistor, the drift and so on. Everything had to be investigated.
Oh, yeah. And were there papers on this sort of thing published in the, engineering journals?
Yes. That's right. Of course, if you, also all the internal reports, but a few papers have been published too, yes.
Okay, so then when it became a Dutch project, it also became a Stichting project, is that correct, at the
same
time?
That's right, yes. Then the government or the ministry wanted to have the Zedeo to supervise the financial side, and it was logical then the Stichting would come in too. Certainly that Lex Müller had been asked to take over the project. You see, when Bill Erickson left, there was some sort of vacuum in the leadership. Nobody really took over after. Ben Oghart did a little while, but it didn't last very long. Well, he had too many things to do. He couldn't really give enough attention. So he did it for a very short time and handed it over to Lex Müller.
And that was...
And Henry Bogart at that time was in Australia.
That was in 65?
Or? Yeah, that was 64.
64. Yeah. Okay, then now what, did it change abruptly, would you say, when Mueller took over, or what, that matter, or did it?
No, well, in the first years, it was still uncertainty about how the antenna would look like. We knew that the money had been cut by half, but we still had to find out the best way to arrange the dishes. And I think that in that period, 64, 65, that's where we came to a decision about the antenna layout. And Hugo had proposed this 28 dishes scheme on an east-west baseline in two rows, one south of the other, if you remember that.
No, I don't know if I've seen that one. That was 28 dishes on the east-west line.
Yes, that's right. Well, we should have to look back into it, but there was a series of dishes on a row, and then a little further south from this one there was another series of dishes, and here you have also a series of dishes on the eastern side. And you would correlate these two rows together and also these two rows together.
I see.
To get all the spacing. It was a more complicated system than... but it was using only fixed dishes. At that time, of course, using movable dishes was still considered as a very difficult matter.
Mm-hmm. And but this was still... Was this 25-meter dishes?
They were 25-meter dishes, but fixed.
That's true. So the movables are, but they're not that much more expensive, are they? That you could afford twice as many dishes?
Okay, but that's right. I don't quite understand. I'm not quite sure that the 28 would have been realistic.
Yeah.
It is a proposal that they did.
But and that was
course,
problems,
the price
yeah.
went up too
yeah.
in the course of time, as you know, and that may be the reason that they couldn't need in these days afford to have so many.
And then what was the next phase after this?
Well, I think then that's before Hugo went to Australia, and then after, during that stay, Wesseling more or less and Müller together took over the decision about the research about the antenna layout, the best antenna layout, and they came down to the system we have now. Actually, not exactly, they went through different phases. The first one they arrived to finally was 10 fixed and 1 movable,
mm-hmm.
which was not a very nice setup. But these days, maybe it was just all right, you know. Movable dishes were still a problem, an unknown problem, an unknown factor in the design. But then, very quickly, Professor Roth managed to get some more money, and we got the second one on the rail.
Right. And also, it was proved at Cambridge that the movable dishes could work. I think the 1 mile came into operation about that time, didn't it? I'm not exactly sure.
Yes.
65.
Before that.
64.
Before that, yes.
Something like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Using the Earth's rotation too. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Oh yeah. That certainly was before.
Yes.
But now, what were you doing simultaneously with receivers during this time, as the dishes were evolving?
Well, we were just working parallel on all sorts of problems, like delay lines, trying to find the best way to find delay lines, delay switches, correlators. We've been playing with all sorts of possible schemes to make correlators, front ends. We were not playing with lower noise with parametric amplifier yet. We were still trying to decrease the noise of conventional balanced mixers, transistor amplifiers, trying to get high gain, synchronously modulated, have them transistorized.
By this time,
on transistor converters, frequency converters, you know, really making a research in all fields so that we could make our own receiver.
By this time, you had convinced yourself that the phase problems were tractable. I mean,
yes.
it could work. Yeah.
Well, one of the problem, of course, with a long array like we were going to have was cable business. So we had a field station in Leiden. At about that time too, we had an Australian Watkinson to help us on that. He stayed for 2 years with us. He's now head of the FLIRS radio telescope field station.
Yeah, I've seen his name.
And we had a field station in Leiden. We had two small aerials. They were 4 meters in diameter, very crude aerials, with a depth shaft to drive them.
Yeah.
And with a baseline of 80 meters. In a field, just in Leiden now, it's a big, huge building at that spot. And we spent some time there testing cables. We had 1 kilometer of very expensive German cables, the one we are using in Westerbork, that's Hediac's cable, and we tested the phase. Conditions.
The dishes were only 80 meters apart,
but
the cable.
We had them rolled up and, in the trench at 1 meter deep, so we could be sure about the behavior.
And
we tested, of course, also the electronics at the same time, and the dishes were not good for tracking, so we made only transit measurements, and we measured transit of radio sources, non-radio sources, to calibrate our phase. And from that, we found out what the stability of transistor electronics was in a big system.
Oh, yeah. And this convinced you that this sort of cable was what you should buy?
That's right, yes. Actually, they came out with a paper, too, showing that it was possible to fully compensate for a thermal effect in cables, because there are two effects, dilatation of the kappa, expansion of kappa, but also change in the properties of the dielectric, and they can compensate one another if you just weigh them properly.
Yeah.
And that's what came out of that investigation by Watkinson, and Ericsson was still there at that time, at least part of it, part of the time. Ericsson really started that field station.
Were there any other field stations of this sort of?
No, there's only one we had.
I've never heard about that one before.
It was called the Pesthuis Polder Field Station. Pesthuis Polder.
Pesthuis Polder.
You know what the polder is?
Yeah.
Pesthuis. Why?
Pesthuis Polder.
Yeah.
And then, so then the dishes actually began, or maybe I should let you tell the story. Okay. What is the next stage then?
When it was really decided what the setup would be, then we really placed the order after that. It was not long after that we really decided to buy them. And we then asked the ministry to definitively allocate the money, because we still didn't have firmly the money in our hand. But it didn't last very long then. I should have to look back into the data again to see when the order was really placed. Around 65, I believe.
Right, for the dishes. And now what about for the cables and the back end components?
Well, everything worked in parallel. Müller was then in charge of the electronics, while Ben Ohart from Leiden was in charge of the mechanical part. Of course, there were interfaces between the two. And Müller was really deciding about organizing the development of the electronics. There were people working in Leiden. The Leiden laboratory was still there, and Lex was working here with his people, part of the people, because the Dringer telescope was still observing at that time. It was still very useful.
So the Leiden laboratory was really a leftover from the Benelux days.
That's right, yes. But I would say that's where most of the staff was. They had only Lex Müller and one engineer, and the engineer was most of the time occupied by the Dringer telescope. So it was only Lex Müller here on this side who was working on the project, Well, in Leiden you had something like 5 engineers.
Yeah.
Of academic level, working on the project. And that's where most of the work